Good evening, everyone. This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And we are live tonight. I know we have been gone, and there's been shows out of the archives. This is August the 2nd, 2013.
Don't look at me.
She doesn't know what day. Julia's here, too. But it's August the 2nd, 2013. Then they know it's supposed to be live if I give that date. So we're going to be live for the whole month of August now. Okay. Let me go ahead and give the toll-free number out in case anyone wants to call in. We're going to have a guest tonight, and I would like it if you do call in to direct your questions to him. Okay, the toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. And we got through our 8th Transformation Conference, and it was fantastic.
Very good, yeah.
Okay, had a good crowd, and everyone just really enjoyed it.
It was very good.
And our guest tonight was one of the speakers. He's one of our new authors.
And he did very good.
Yes, he did. Normally, I try to have the speakers on before the conference, but it was impossible. We were in Canada. We were all over the place. In fact, we were up pretty close in Garnett's neck of the woods.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Our guest tonight is Garnett Schulhauser. And Garnett, you're over in Victoria, aren't you?
Yes, that's right, Dolores.
Uh-huh. We were in Edmonton, which is over that way.
It's not too far away, and Edmonton's just about 200 miles north of Calgary, where I spent most of my life. So, yeah, you were in my neck of the woods for sure.
Yeah, we had to transfer planes in Calgary.
Right, we did.
Yeah.
But finally, we're trying to calm down now after everything and relax for a little bit, but everything is really crazy. That's what I was wondering. Have you noticed anything, Garnett? It seems like something's going on to where everything seems to be happening at once.
Yeah, the pace of activity has certainly increased in my view. Just from talking to people and what I read and what I see on TV, I think things are increasing. We're picking up the pace. I hope we're going in the right direction, but it certainly seems to be busier.
Hope so. Well, it feels pretty crazy in the process, but
that's what we feel. You know, usually we're hectic anyway, but this seems like everything coming from all different directions.
It's hectic on steroids.
So I'll be thinking it would calm down, but it's still kind of wild. Okay, but Garnett is one of our new authors, and he wrote the book Dancing on a Stamp. And I just think that is a really fascinating title. And I'm not going to tell you what it means right now. We'll let him do that as we go through the show. But Garnett, I always like to start by letting the guest talk about your background. Tell how you got into this and how you got started. Let's hear from you about your background.
Okay, well, I was born and raised in a small farm in Saskatchewan in the Canadian prairies, and I was raised in a very religious Roman Catholic family. That was my background. And we went to church. It seemed like, to my mind, we went to church more than we did anything else. My mother was a very strong religious person, and she was very determined that her husband and her 5 children all got to heaven with her, even if she had to drag us kicking and screaming. So she was the parade marshal, so to speak, and she sort of led the way on the religious front. And I was, like any good Catholic boy, I was an altar boy in our parish church for a number of years, and we did all the things that good Catholics did, and we learned all the rules and beliefs that they taught us. Anyway, by the time I hit my teenage years, though, I was getting a little skeptical about some of their rules and beliefs, which didn't make any sense to me. And then I sort of, as I went through to my 30s, I sort of slowly drifted away from what I was taught. Probably by my late 30s, I had sort of rejected a lot of what they had taught me, and I was sort of in no man's land. I had rejected one set of beliefs, but I hadn't found anything else to replace it. So I was casting about looking for answers to all the questions that I've been asking throughout my life that most adults ask at one point or another, you know, all the eternal questions like, who am I, why am I here, what's my purpose, and what happens to me after I die? And I hadn't sort of found any answers that really satisfied me until one day I met a homeless man on the street whose name was Albert, who gave me all the answers. And it's sort of an interesting, do you want me to say how I met Albert?
Yeah, well, no, you were in the corporate world too, weren't you?
Yes. You see, when I met Albert, I was practicing law as a corporate lawyer in Calgary, in Canada. And I spent like most of my adult life there practicing law. So one day in how I met Albert, this homeless man, which is kind of an interesting story, I decided to go for a walk to get some fresh air one sunny afternoon in May. So I walked out in the street in front of our building, which is a pedestrian mall. It's close to traffic. And I was just walking down the street, my mind sort of in the clouds, as usual. And all of a sudden, this homeless man jumps out of nowhere and stops me in my tracks. Now, he looked like a very typical homeless man. He had long, greasy hair and scraggly beard, and his clothes were dirty, and they looked like they'd been slept in for weeks. And usually what I would do when I met or encountered homeless people on this mall, I just do a quick sidestep and go right around them, because usually they're asking for money. But this man was very different, because he had amazing, dazzling, sparkling blue eyes that shone like two little blue stars is the best way I can describe it. And so I stopped and I looked at this man and looked into his eyes, and his eyes were penetrating deeply inside me. I felt like he was looking right into the bottom of my soul, and that he knew everything about me, and even though we'd never met before. And I felt like he knew everything I'd ever said or done in my life. And so I was standing there feeling a bit naked and exposed to this man, but I wasn't. I didn't feel violated, because at the same time, his eyes were sending me this amazing wave of pure unconditional love that was just slowly infusing my body with an amazing feeling of peace and security. And so it was a wonderful feeling, something I'd never encountered before. And so I was standing there like a deer caught in the headlights, almost like I was in a time warp, and I had no idea how long it lasted, but I didn't care. It could have lasted forever as far as I was concerned. It was such a wonderful feeling. And then he finally just sort of broke the spell. He said to me, "Why are you here?" And then he just quickly disappeared into a nearby store. And when I finally collected my wits, I looked around and I thought, well, I better go find this guy. So I went into the store that he had gone into, and there was only one entrance and one exit. And I didn't see him come out, but he wasn't in the store anywhere. So I walked up and down that same street for a while trying to find him, but I couldn't find him. He was just totally gone. So I walked back to my office with my head in a daze, trying to figure out what had happened. Like, was this a real encounter? Was I dreaming? You know, who was this guy? And so that night I kept on, at home, I kept on asking these questions, and I knew that I had to come back the next day to see if I could find this guy. He was just a fascinating person, and I needed to talk to him. So the next day, at the very same time, I went back onto the same street, and I walked up and down hoping I could find him. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, I was ready to give up, and then I spotted him sitting on a bench all by himself. So I walked over to him, and I said to him, "Why did you ask me that question?" He said, "You've been asking a lot of questions all your life, and I'm here to give you the answers and to help you on your journey." And so, despite the fact that his eyes are still sending me this wave of pure unconditional love, my lawyer brain then kicked in, and I became a little skeptical, and I said, "Well, why do you think you can help me? Because it doesn't look like you could even help yourself. You've been sleeping in the street for weeks, and you smell like a dead fish." he smiled at me, and he said, "You know, looks can be deceiving." He said, "You look like you're a respected, successful corporate lawyer with everything under control, but we both know that's just a facade." He said, you can just turn around and go back to your office and see if you can find all your answers in those emails waiting on your computer, or you can sit down and take a chance with me and talk to me." So my intuition then sort of kicked in, and I knew that he was right, that this guy was a special guy, and I really needed to talk to him. And, you know, what the heck, I had nothing to lose but a few minutes of a sunny afternoon. So I sat down and we started our conversation, which sort of led to a series of conversations over several months. And he answered all my questions and a lot more that popped into my mind as we were talking. So it was really quite an amazing encounter.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you figured out who he was after a while, didn't you?
Yeah, you see, he early on he told me that he was actually one of my spirit guides disguised as a homeless man.
Uh-huh.
And he said that he came to me, you see, the first three appearances he appeared as a homeless man. After that, he was just a voice in my head, and we just communicated by telepathy. And when I asked him why this all happened, he said, well, if I had just started talking to you as a voice in your head, you probably would have thought you were going crazy, and you would have dismissed it and not listened to me. So I had to do something to get your attention, to engage you in the conversation. So I came to you as the homeless man. And he said, I was actually the only person who could see him as a homeless man. I could see him and actually feel him. He was like flesh and bones to me. But he said no one else could see him. And if somebody had been walking by the bench or the bench that we were sitting on that day, they would have seen me sitting by myself, talking to myself. They wouldn't have seen Albert. I'm sorry?
Being a crazy person.
Yeah, they would have thought I was crazy, yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, there is a book out there. I don't know who wrote it, but it was called My Guardian Angel Wears Tennis Shoes. And so, you know, they can appear in any way, any strange ways. People often talk about having one of them will come and save their life, and then they just suddenly disappear. So, we know they can just appear in many different ways. It's not what you're really expecting.
No, exactly, and sometimes they'll deliberately come in a very unusual form to grab your attention or to see how you react to them. Anyway, so this Albert was my homeless man, and he played the part very well. And I sort of now I look at homeless people in a much different way because you never know whether one of them might be somebody who's other than who they seem to be. So.
Right.
Well, it says in the Bible, you never know, you may be, you may be entertaining an angel unaware.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that could very well be. But Albert was my angel, and he was had a very good disguise as a homeless man, and we had a great series of conversations. And it was, the interesting thing about Albert was that he didn't lecture or preach to me. He wasn't like sort of coming from a sermon on high to me. We just talked like we're talking right now, he had a great sense of humor, and he'd often tease me and poke fun at me for some of the silly things I've done in my life, it was sort of like two friends sitting down chatting over a beer. It was really a great conversation, it was an amazing change for me, that's why I wrote the book, because partway through the conversation, I said to, when he was telling me all these wonderful things, which just felt right to me, I said to him, you know, Albert, what you're telling me would provide a lot of comfort to a lot of other people in the world, and you should really let them hear your message. And Albert said, well, they are going to hear it because you are going to write a book. And that was the first time it ever occurred in my life that I would write a book. Like, I was a lawyer, and I'm not an author. And I even said to Albert, well, you know, I don't know, you're... Why are you picking an Albert or an amateur like me to write your book? I've never written a book before. Why don't you get somebody that's accomplished, an author like Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, to write your book? But he said, well, I have my reasons, and someday I'll let you know. But in the meantime, you're it, and so stop your whining and get on with the book.
Yeah. And, you know, if you had refused, your life would have been misery.
Oh, yeah. No, you see, instinctively I knew that... I just had to do it. It's like, and I've learned since then that you can't win an argument with spirit. Eventually, they're going to win. And so I knew that if I didn't do it, I'd regret it forever. It was one of those things I had to do. But having said that, once I started writing the book, I still had some doubts in my mind about, well, okay, I can write it, but should I actually get it published and let anybody else see it? Because I knew that there would be a lot of my former colleagues and partners in law and former clients who would wonder what I was doing when they read my book, and some of them I knew would reject what I had said, and some would think I was crazy, and
oh,
so
yeah.
I was a bit concerned about that. But I just thought after a while, well, I have to do it, and if I lose some friends because of it, you know, let the chips fall where they may. I mean, we're all on our own journeys, and I have to be on the one that I should take, and the one that Albert has sort of pointed me towards. So I wrote the book, and and now it's published.
That's right.
And you did an excellent job. You would never know it was an amateur at all. It was really a good writing.
Well, thank you very much.
And Julie has always said, too, she knows what happens if you don't listen to me,
well,
don't pay
and like,
attention.
You know, and I'm, like I was saying, I resisted so much. It was like, get somebody who knows how to do this. I was doing the same thing, and it took a long time. And then, but the same way, I knew I was supposed to do it, but I resisted and resisted. And I said that in my talks, they don't care who they give their assignments to. You don't have to be an artist. You don't have to be professional at this. They give it to who, you know, I don't know how they pick them. But just do it. So.
Well, I think it's all planned beforehand before we're born, Julia. We just don't remember it. That's all. But I'm certain that with Albert and I know for sure that it was all planned that this would happen, where it would happen, how it would happen before I was born. But of course, we forget where we came from or what was in our life plans before once we're born. And so, of course, Albert knew what was coming up, but I didn't. But that's the way it is with life on Earth. You don't get to remember what you had planned to do before you were born, so.
Right. I felt like I probably had a window. It was like the plan was to do this, and I had a window that it needed to be accomplished in this certain period of time, like these different things. And whenever you resist, it's like, or you had so much time, because it was just a year, like a year ago, I got the message, if you don't do this, we're going to give it to someone else. And that got my attention, and then I got it done.
Yeah.
So, it was like, this has to be done. Now, it's either you or somebody else, but you set this out to do it. So, mm-hmm.
But yeah, well, you know, you've come to the same conclusion that I have in my work. We do make plans before we come in. We do it on the spirit side before we come into the body of what we're supposed to do, and we do forget when we come in. Right. But our guides, our guardian angels, they know our plan.
Well, that's why they're there, is to help
yeah.
us stay on the plan.
Yeah, absolutely. They know the plan, and they're supposed to be our coaches. They're supposed to try to help us stay on
yeah.
on the path that we had planned, except that they don't get to sort of speak directly to most people like Albert was speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
That was very much of an exception, and he said that he's speaking to me to get his message out to everyone, but he doesn't give me guidance on my sort of personal life or day-to-day stuff. He said that I still have to rely on listening to my guides. And the problem is that our guides have to give us very subtle messages like, you know, intuitive thoughts or gut feelings or, you know, synchronicity events, coincidental events, whatever. And we have to be able to try to listen to those messages and understand them and then act on them. And all too often our minds are so cluttered with day-to-day thoughts that we just don't hear it or we ignore it or if we do hear it, we just dismiss it and say, no, I think I've got a better course of action and I don't want to do what you're telling me sort of thing, just like Julia said. And then, you know, we can resist for a while, but eventually they'll win out.
Right. I may have missed this, but you said that him appearing to you was a very rare thing for them to do. So why did he do that with you?
Yeah, I think he did it just because he knew that he wasn't going to get very far if he just started talking to me as a voice in my head, and so he decided that he needed to really grab my attention in a way that wouldn't scare me away or you know make me run and hide. So he showed up as the homeless man. I mean, he didn't say. I mean, there are the guides and angels who appear to people, you know, over the time. You know, mankind's history, as Dolores was mentioning, and they can appear in various forms, but it's very rare. Like Albert wasn't the only case that it ever happened in. Other people have encountered angels and guides as well, but it's not a really very common thing, and it's a, sort of a very rare exception. And Albert was one of those occurrences for me. But in terms of my other guides, he wouldn't tell me who my other guides are. And I have to sort of try to listen for messages like everyone else in terms of what I do in my personal life. And so I have the same struggle that everyone else does. And some people hear their guides better than others. And it's just a matter of how good of a listener we are.
Yeah, I always tell people, listen to those instincts, those gut feelings. But, you know, a lot of times they could be a normal person. and just come into our life for just a little bit, and we wouldn't even know who they were. But they might appear just like a normal person.
Well, and I had an instance happen, and I'm still trying to figure out why it happened. Because nothing really happened around it that I recall. But we had done, Mom, this is back when Mom was practicing her technique, so it was a long time ago. And in one of her sessions, one of her things she does is she takes you to meet your guide, a guardian angel. And so in that, I met this man who kind of like looked Indian or whatever, and he had the toga or whatever they wear, you know, and he asked his name, and his name was Maruk, M-A-R-U-K. Anyway, it goes through this whole process. Well, then right after that, I was in college, and you came down to see us in Texas, and we went to this store in this mall. And we're in this store, it's a boutique, and it's actually an Indian store. And this man comes up, and he's the storekeeper. All of a sudden, it's like there was nobody in this store. Even though you and a friend were in there, you were off someplace else. This man comes up, he's the owner, and he's talking to me about something. I don't remember what we were talking about. But then he gives me his card. I end up buying something, but he gave me his card. Later, I looked at it because I felt this connection with this man. And I later looked at the card, and his name was Kumar, K-U-M-A-R. It was almost like the same word just moved, you know, the same letters exactly. And I got this overwhelming feeling that was my guide. But I was like, but I don't remember him saying anything that was profound or anything. I was like,
but you
why?
You did say you had a funny feeling the whole time you were with him.
Right.
So we never know. It can be something real subtle or real, you wouldn't even think about it later. But sometimes all those things can alter our path.
And that's what it's intended to do, Dolores, I think, is that when you get when these occasions happen, there's a message that we're supposed to get from it, and we're supposed to, yeah, change the direction or take a different path or do something that we're not doing. It doesn't always dawn on us right away what exactly the message is, but... sounds very much, Julia, like that you met one of your guides.
You know, and like I said, I don't remember what we talked about, but I remember him. I remember the event to this day. And we're probably talking, I don't know, 35 years ago at least. So, I remember it just like it happened. I just don't remember what we talked about. So that, to me, has something right there. But...
Yeah, otherwise, why would it stick in your mind after all those years?
Right. I've kept his card ever since then.
Back, Julia, to see if he's still there.
Pardon?
You should go back to the shop to see if he's still there.
Well, that's what we said. We wondered if we went back once I looked at his card, because I didn't look at it at that time. I looked at it a little later, and I got the chills and everything. It was like, oh, my goodness. But we wondered, but we never did go back. We said, I wonder if the store is still there if we go back.
Yeah, that happens a lot of times. The things just disappear.
Right.
In and out of time. But I know when you were giving your wonderful lecture, I kept thinking it was almost word from word from my book, Between Death and Life. And you said you haven't really read any of my books, have you?
Well, I've read the Convoluted Universe series and the Three Waves of Volunteers. I read those after my manuscript was in your hands, actually. But I haven't read the book you just mentioned, no. But, you know, the interesting thing is that the messages that are coming from Spirit are coming through many different ways. You know, they come through your clients, Dolores, and they come to me through Albert. And there's a lot of different ways the messages are coming across. And I think... In my view, they seem to be increasing the pace of the messages they have a reason for it, and it's but the messages seem to be fairly consistent, as you have mentioned before.
Yeah, see, I was writing that book in the 1980s, and it was printed in the 90s, and it's still in print, and it's all over the world. But, you know, when they was giving me all that information about life after death and where you go, what it's like and what happens, it was, to me, startling because there wasn't anything out there at that time. But to hear you saying, I said, it's just word for word. And I always say, if there is a similarity, then that gives it validity. We know it's coming from the right place. because we can't make up the same thing.
Well, it's confirmation.
It's confirmation, yeah.
I've noticed, like you're saying, it's coming from a lot of, I feel a sense of urgency, a real sense of urgency from spirit. It's like we have got to get, I think that's why they're putting so many messages through so many different people. It's like we have got to get this stuff figured out.
Yeah, because I get hundreds of submissions of manuscripts, and I read them all. But many, many of them are like this, the same information. And, of course, some of it is written better than others, but that tells me it, they're trying their best they can to get it through anybody, just
right.
So it will come out.
Right.
What do you call that? It's like the Hunter's Monkey Syndrome. You, with enough people, eventually.
You flood the market.
Yeah, flood the market.
Yeah, I think they're trying to flood the market with the messages, and it's coming in, as I said, from all sources and from too many different peoples in many different books. And because the message is more or less the same, it's just confirmation, and they're just trying to make sure that it gets spread as widely as they can. And I think, Julie, you're right. I think I detect a sense of urgency that they want to really pick up the pace because they think we're at a crucial point, and we need to get as many people on side as we can. And that's why the message or the amount of messages and the degree of messages have been increasing and coming out and being more widespread over the last number of years. I think you're right, Dolores. Before, I can recall back when I was in university days, I can't recall anyone ever talking about the things that Albert and I discussed or reading about it or hearing about it anywhere. I mean, it just didn't seem, maybe it was there, but it wasn't something that I was aware of. And then now, of course, you can find all kinds of people talking about it and writing books about it. I think it's just because that humans are at a place where they're more ready to accept the message and to understand it and to deal with it. So I think that's why it's happening.
Well, see, that's what I was going to say. You know, I've been doing this for 45 years since the 1960s. I've watched it evolve. Because I think it's mostly been in the last 10 years we've seen the changes.
Well, it's been a huge shift in the last 10 years.
Because before that, it's the same way I would give lectures and there'd be all these skeptics out there in the 80s and the 90s. And this was something you just didn't talk about, life after death or the eternal soul and none of that. The churches, they thought you were going against the churches.
Kind of an underground thing. You had little meetings.
We were called the underground.
Yeah.
We would have meetings and discuss this, and nobody was supposed to know where we were meeting and what we were talking about. But now the things are changing with the audiences that it's becoming more mainstream. And it's no longer the forbidden topics as it used to be.
Yeah, what surprised me, what sort of was confirmation of that, was that I was... As I said, I was concerned about some of my former partners and clients and friends from back in Calgary. Like when I wrote the book, I had retired out to Vancouver Island, so I'd left Calgary. I was concerned about what they would say. And I got an amazing number of emails from people who I thought were sort of straight-laced, organized religion people who would just shake their heads and say, we think this guy has lost his mind. I got some emails from these people who were very supportive, who said, you know, thanks for having the courage to write your book and release it. Thanks for helping me on my own spiritual journey. And I really, really enjoyed your book. And I was very surprised at some of the people, the emails from some of the people who I never thought in a million years would ever, sign on or agree with the message or accept it. So I think there's a lot of people who are, to use Sherry Cortland's term, who are still in the spiritual closet, but who are, got one foot out the door and you're about to come out. And I think more and more of them are going to do that in the next while.
Well, that's why they were hiding too. They didn't want to discuss these things, afraid of what other people were going to say. So they keep it in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my concerns was about in my own family. I have three sisters who are still practicing Catholics. And I thought, what are they going to say? Are they going to, because I'm not, if you read what Albert's message, I mean, he's dissing a lot of the beliefs of the Catholic Church and a lot of the rules. And I thought, I wonder what they're going to say. Maybe they'll quit talking to me, but they were all quite good. And I'm not sure they fully signed on yet, but they didn't denounce me or anything. And we're still talking. So that's something. And it gave them food for thought, I think. And I, even though they're still carrying on with their ways, and that's fine because everyone has their own journey to carry out. And you know, as Albert told me, it doesn't matter whether people sign on to the message I'm giving them. You know, it'd be nice if they did, but if they don't, it's not the end of the world. And when they cross back over to the spirit side, then they'll know. So yeah. Sooner or later, everyone will realize what the truth is and the way the universe works.
Yeah, but is your mother still alive?
No, she's not. No. Interesting story about my mother. when I was speaking to a spiritual group a few months ago, this is a group of people who are sort of in a spiritual book club, and I was telling them about my book and about meeting Albert and all that sort of thing, and how my mother had raised us in a very religious Roman Catholic family. And one of the people said to me, "Well, what would your mother think of your book?" And I said, "Well, if she was still living on Earth, she wouldn't think very much of it at all. In fact, she wouldn't like it. But I said, she's now over on the spirit side, and I'm sure she's 100% behind what I said in my book." And after that, I finished the talk, one of the ladies who was in the group came up to me, and she was a medium. And she said, "You know, when you were telling the story about your mother and whether she'd like the book or not, your mother appeared behind you, and she was giving you two thumbs up as you were talking," which made me feel good.
Okay. But Demille, to show you the difference, though, when I got into this in the 1960s, nobody was discussing anything. There was no New Age. There was no metaphysics. Hardly anybody in the Western world believed in reincarnation. I got into all of that. And I was teaching Sunday school in the Protestant church and singing in the choir, all of that. They put me out of the church because they thought I was having seances and talking to the dead. So that shows you how far we have come.
That would have meant you were talking to the devil.
Oh, yeah. They thought I was working with the devil for sure.
Yeah, and a few centuries earlier, you might have been burnt at the stake for doing that.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, we have progressed a lot, and we still have a ways to go, but there's more and more people who are just accepting it, and I think it's probably because they're... In a lot of cases, they're rejecting the organized religion they grew up with and looking for something new to replace it. And, you know, if the new message coming out is, my view, you know, a way better message, it's a message of love and hope, and it's a message that doesn't have guilt and fear built into it, like a lot of religions use to try to control people, you know, because, I mean, as Albert said, the source or God doesn't control what happens to us on Earth. It doesn't choose our lives for us because we do that ourselves, and we're not judged or punished after we die. We all go back to the spirit side, and so that to a lot of people is a lot of comfort and relief. It's like, now I don't have to worry about going to hell after I die because I'm going back to the same place as I came from, and you know, I can keep on coming back until I learn all my lessons. And And that's very comforting to a lot of people.
Yeah, and to me, what I found, it's a very loving message. And I wish the churches would teach these things because there is a lot of hope in it. People wouldn't be so afraid.
Well, I mean, when I was in nursing and I would work intensive care, I'd work these things, I'd see people, you know, they're dying and they are scared to death because they are so afraid of what's going to happen and everything. And that's purely because of the church and because of the religion. And it ingrained that so severely. These people were petrified. And that's sad.
And you said they lived a good life, but
well, they
were, because they weren't perfect, they were going to hell.
Yeah, they were going to hell. I mean, they all knew they did something. Everybody's done something. And no matter how good life they lived, they still did something.
Yes. Well,
yes,
I could certainly equate with that, Julia, because I remember when I was a youngster, even at that stage, of being afraid of dying and going to hell and all that sort of thing, because and that just all came from the church, which I don't think makes any sense trying to, I mean, it makes no sense to scare adults, never mind young children, but that's sort of the atmosphere that we grew up in and what they were trying to get across to us. If we can scare these guys enough, they will follow our rules. But you know, it's not worth it because people shouldn't fear death. They should just look at it as a transition, a doorway to another place.
Well, in my book, I say they're just going home.
Yeah, it is home. Yeah, And the other thing that people that grew up with religion who are still hanging on to it that they find disturbing is the fact that, as Albert said, is that everyone goes back to the spirit side. Everyone goes home, no matter what you did on Earth. So even the murderers and the terrorists, they all end up back on the spirit side. And people will say, well, how is it fair that the bad guys go to heaven after they, you know, after they die? That's not fair. And Albert's answer is, well, you know, life on Earth is, you know, you won't understand it till you get back there. But it's like a play, and it's like, you know, if you're playing the part of somebody who has to stab another actor in the play, well, you don't get, when the play's over, you don't get arrested by the police because they know it's not real, and it's like life on Earth. It's not really real, and it's like a play. And when you get back to the spirit side, everyone says, okay, well, you played that part, and I played this part, and now let's get our heads together and plan our next lives. You know, it's that's the way you look at it when you're back there. Here, you don't understand it, which is the problem.
Love analogy. I love the analogy of the police coming in and arresting you.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm always telling people in my therapy work too. Is everybody has bad things happen in their life. That's what life's all about. Is we're in a school here. We're learning lessons. And I tell them, did you learn anything from the bad experience? And if you learned one thing, then that was the reason for you experiencing that. It's part of the lesson. And sometimes they'll say, well, I didn't learn anything. It was just a bad experience. And if they think that way, well, guess what? They got to come back and take that class over again. They didn't pass it.
Yeah, you got to keep on, yeah.
They can look at it like that. What did I learn? That was the reason I planned that circumstance. Of course, that makes them take responsibility, and they don't like that.
That's a scary thing for some people.
Well, you know, the thing is, when you realize that, it's then you have to sort of acknowledge that you're never a victim. You can't say that you're a victim of the arbitrary universe or some God that's doing things to you. I mean, you create your own reality. I mean, you write your script before you're born, and then as you're here, your free will actions, you sort of continually change the script and rewrite it, and you just create your own reality. And so you don't have no one to blame for the bad experiences in your life. It's something that you wrote into your script and something that you caused, when you reacted to what happened to you. Because part of your reality is how you react to the events. You can react positively or you can be negative about it. And, you know, you can see the glass half full or half empty. And so that's how you create your reality. And if you want to be happy, you can be happy. If you want to be miserable, you can be miserable. That's whatever happens to you. You can have the same. You have the same choice.
Yeah, you're doing it to yourself. That's what I tell people. But a lot of them, you know, they have these bad things happen, and then they get so swallowed up in that they don't realize they can come out.
Well, like you said, yeah, you're the victim mode at that point.
Yeah.
And you have to get out of that. I mean, you can't. Once you understand this, you can no longer be a victim. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love about it, because it empowers people at that point.
If they accept it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, that's their free will.
Yeah, we do have free will.
Yeah, that's one of the things that makes the Earth School so tough is having the free will and not knowing, not remembering what's in your life plan or that you even have one, or where you came from, or that you were here before. So that's why Earth is such a tough place. And I guess we should all sort of pat ourselves in the back, because the fact that we're here in human bodies on Earth means that we're pretty brave souls to try it out, because it's not an easy school.
That's what Julie is always saying. You almost word for word.
Because
I know.
It's almost like we're in contact with the same source.
Because I've been told Earth is the most difficult planet to live on.
Most challenging.
Challenging planet in the universe.
Wow.
It's the heaviest, the most challenging. And they said, when you come to Earth, sign on to come to Earth, you're greatly admired because they know what you're getting into. And they try to discourage you because they know it's going to be very hard. But it is the hardest one. You come to Earth to learn emotions and limitations. And we have free will, which no other planet has. So it's a different type of planet than anywhere else you can live on. So a lot to be learned here. So you are very brave to come in.
And then what I've gotten is we only master manifestors can come here. So like you said, we have to be some pretty remarkable souls or beings, whatever you want to call us, to come here. It's not just anybody that can play this game.
Yeah. She keeps calling it the Earth game.
I call it Game Board Earth.
Game Board Earth. Mm-hmm.
good description, Julia.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what we found out, that the, here again, it's, what was I going to say there? I lost my thought. It has to do with us being difficult and coming in here.
Oh, master manifestors.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They told me that the greatest lesson you have to learn in the school of Earth is to learn how to manipulate energy, because everything is energy. And they said, that's one thing you have to learn before you graduate from the Earth School, is how to manipulate energy. Now, what does that mean? That means learn how to create. It show how powerful your minds are. Julie is always saying we are great and powerful beings. But you have to learn how to manipulate the energy to create.
We just have to remember who and what we are.
And that's important, and it shows there again, you can create your reality, you can create your life, because you do have control of it. You're writing your own script.
Right, and I think that, Julia's right, because we know how to manipulate energy on the spirit side, we have to, when we get here, of course, we forget all that, and we have to try to remember it and or relearn it, however you want to say it, to be better at creating our own lives and living our lives in a more loving and compassionate manner, and getting rid of our negative emotions, which is the real sort of the thing that drags humans down most of the time. It has since they started living on Earth, and that's the goal, is to try to shut down the negative emotions and embrace the love and the compassion and the forgiveness, so that we can move forward. That's why all these messages are coming to us.
Yeah. And that's when I've written books on Jesus, too. And in there, that's what I said. The only reason he came to Earth was to show us how to advance, that we were caught in the wheel of karma, going round and around, making the same mistakes over and over again. We weren't advancing. We weren't ascending, going up the ladder. And that he came to show us how to live and how to progress. And it all goes back to love. Love is the greatest force in the universe, but they didn't understand, and they killed him.
Right, and I asked Albert about Jesus Christ, and he said, the soul that incarnated as Jesus was a great, highly evolved soul, a master, came to Earth, as you say, to help us. He didn't need to learn or experience anything. He came to help help humans, and he tried his best, and I think he's had a large effect in the world. I mean, if you look at how many Christians there are in the world, it's huge. It's, over 2 billion or whatever. But the trouble was that the people who followed him, the religious men who sort of shaped the church, they had their own agendas. A lot of times they just went off track, and that was the problem.
Because this was not at all what he was teaching in the beginning.
No, not at all, no.
He had brought in their own rules and regulations.
The man control stuff.
Yeah, that's what it was all about. It was no longer about love and how to progress. So, we aren't going against all of that. It's just that the man rules and regulations is what doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that's what I rebelled against, Dolores, was all these rules, some of which were very silly, I thought, and didn't make any sense. And I didn't like all the guilt and fear that they were throwing at us, they should. And the message from Jesus was love. Love your fellow person as the same as yourself. That he was the same message. Like we're all part of the source, part of God, and we're not really separate. And we need to love each other like we're all one. But somehow that message got sort of shuffled off to the side as men sort of grabbed a hold of it and created their own vision of the church and created a bunch of rules . That's where they've gone off course, and that's why a lot of people are leaving organized religions and have over the last number of years, just because they're realizing the same thing. And it's too bad that the message of love that Jesus gave to us was just distorted and shuffled off to the side. It's really unfortunate.
Well, that's what I found. And in the beginning, all the religions all believed the same. They all believed in God, in the source, whatever they wanted to call it. And it was a great power, and it was total love. And they all believed that. And
they
then,
all believed reincarnation, too. Right?
Yeah, they all believed in reincarnation. They believed in all of that. And then, over these centuries, man came in and divided them up into different religions and brought in their own rules and regulations, not realizing it was all the same in the beginning.
Yeah, but that's just the way humans, how they handle things and have handled things over the last while, and they're sort of more after chasing their own desires and goals and their own and pursuing their own agendas, and they forget about what the core message was, and it just gets distorted. That's really unfortunate. But we're starting to get the message back from spirit side, the message of love and hope and forgiveness. And they're trying to sort of get us, steer us back on course, I think, and that's a very good thing. And we just have to listen to the message and try to persuade other people to follow it.
It all got bogged down in this with this world we live in, like we said, because it's very difficult to live here. We all got bogged down in it and got lost.
Well, like you said, the messages are coming through to all walks of life.
I mean,
here you're an attorney, and you're getting this right in your face, you know, I mean, and that's happening all of the time. It's just everyone. Like, get it
because
straight.
We traveled all over the world constantly, and we're seeing it. We see the changes, and people are beginning to understand.
They're waking up. You see a shift happening. People go, I don't see anything. You just have to look. It's all over the place.
Well, and Dolores and Julie, you're both contributing, to the cause. I mean, Dolores, you've been doing this for I don't know how many years and spreading the message, and that's we need more people like you to get the message out there and you're working very tirelessly to help, and that's a big aid, and we all need to try to find some way of getting our own message out in our own way, to whether it's just to your next door neighbor or whether it's to a group of 20 people or to the world on a internet radio show or whatever. I think we have to all work at it and mm-hmm. keep it flowing so that we keep everyone or help everyone wake up and hear the message.
But they said, in my work, we're not out to convert anybody, because if they're not ready to listen, it just goes right over their head. And that we wait, we have the answers. And whenever they begin asking the right questions, then we have the answers to give them. But we're not supposed to go out and try to convert anybody or change their lives. That's not what it's about. I say we drop crumbs. And if they pick up the crumbs, then we know they're interested.
Right, but somebody has to be in the vanguard to drop the crumbs so that the people who are ready can follow the trail, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's why I think that the message is coming to people like you and Julia and myself and a lot of other people. To use your analogy, we're there to be dropping the crumbs so that people who are ready to be awakened can pick up the trail and follow along.
Yeah, I say we give them a spoonful, digest this, then we'll give you another spoonful. But you can't just give them a whole loaf of bread. They won't understand and they won't even listen.
Well, and like you're saying, Garnett, like where you were coming from, I mean, you have recovering religious, groups, recovering Catholics and everything. These beliefs have been so indoctrinated, that's a lot to work through to even think of anything different.
Oh, yeah. No, we were force-fed this from the time we were just youngsters and all the way through, and it's really hard to shake that. I mean, And even though you have doubts about it, at least in the back of my mind, I was going through this slow rejection of the beliefs, was that, well, what if they are right? And what if I will go to hell if I don't sort of follow the rules and I don't go to church on Sunday? You know, that nagging doubt was there for a long time. And I think that's the problem for a lot of people, is that they just aren't quite ready yet to jettison the old regime and latch on to the new one, and they have fears. I mean, the fear of death and what happens to me after I die, that's always there, I guess.
That reminds me of something that happened to me. I think it was something that needed to happen because at a point where my belief, I guess I needed to have my own belief system because at that point I was believing what Mom was doing. I was believing it because she was what she was doing. I didn't have my own set of beliefs. And I had someone was determined to save me. And so they brought me, you know, and they were just telling me how bad everything I was doing was. And, I mean, they were making me question everything myself. And what if I do? What if this is all wrong? Like you're saying, that's where I think that's a natural thing. You go, what if they're right? What if all of this is wrong? And so it made me completely question everything. And so I think I had to completely tear down that belief structure and start over with my own so that it was solid for me,
mm-hmm.
not basing it on anybody else's say-so. And now it's unshakable because I know.
Well, in the beginning, it was the same way. This little voice in the back of my head kept saying, this is heresy. You can't talk like this because it is ingrained in us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're coming down to the wire. Garnett, I want you to tell them what the title of the book means. Dancing on a Stamp.
Well, it's interesting. It arose in one of the conversations I was having at Albert, and he said to me, he said, you know, one of the problems that you've had with your life is that you've spent too much of your time dancing on a stamp. And I said, well, what do you mean by dancing on a stamp? And he said, well, imagine that you're in the middle of a big, beautiful ballroom, and the band is playing great dance music, and everyone's up and dancing, and they're swirling all around and enjoying the dance floor and enjoying the music. And he said, but you spent too much of your time standing on one spot, like you have leg shackles on, and you need to quit dancing on a stamp. And so that phrase kept on sticking in my mind. And when I finished my manuscript and I was looking for a title for the book, that phrase kept on popping up because it's kind of an unusual phrase. And so I said to Albert, what if I use for my title for my book, Dancing on a Stamp? And he said, sounds good, go for it. And so that's where the title came from.
Well, that was intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Garnett, before we go off, tell people if anybody wants to contact you about the book or about they just want to email you or talk to you, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, they can email. I have a website. It's simple. It's dancingonastamp.com, and on there is my email address, which is just contact@dancingonastamp.com. So I'd be happy to hear from people, emails. You know, and I always respond to them all. I haven't gotten so many so far that I can't, but I try to respond to them all. I'd be happy to hear from them. And on my website, there's a bunch of links for where they can click on to buy the book, including the Ozark Mountain page and some of the online sites. So if they can't find it in a bricks and mortar store, they can certainly get it online. And I'd be happy to hear from anyone out there who's listening.
Okay. And once you open that door, then you begin to get a lot of mail.
Uh-huh.
We get so much.
I think so.
To them anymore, but I try to read everything anyway. But you're starting out. You're going to get to that point.
And one thing I liked about you, Garnett, you're very approachable. So I want to put that out there that nobody needs to be afraid of you. You're very approachable. You're easy to talk to.
Don't think he's a lawyer. He's very down to earth.
Yeah, well, I remember my roots, and I grew up in a small farm in the prairies in Canada. So you never sort of forget that. And so I try to be approachable, and I welcome all the comments, and I'm delighted to hear from people.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on tonight.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Well, it's time to sign off now, so good night, everyone, and thanks for listening.
Good night.